Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Professor Mihaela Uliru, President of Impact Institute, a global ICT innovation innovator, luminary, and authority. Mihaela, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Stephen.
And Mihaela, forgive me for the pronunciation of your name, and for the audience's sake, perhaps you can state your name.
Mihaela Uliru.
Thank you so much for that.
I do not blame anyone, unless you are born in Romania, I do not think you can pronounce my name correctly. So.
Well, I'll try my best throughout the interview. Okay, Mihaela, what are the policies required for organizational transformation in this digital economy?
Well, Stephen, you're not asking me easy questions. You cannot approach this by thinking in terms of the industrial society that is concerned with the optimal management of scarce resources. The problem is that this is the way of thinking in which we have been brought up. These are the schools of thought that taught us. But well, let me begin by framing the conversation. The rules and structures of decisioning appropriate to harnessing the potential benefits of the digital environment extend beyond that of the traditional management of coordination. The digital environment and its economics represent what I would call a post-scarcity paradigm, because it is based on the human wealth of knowledge and the increasing returns arising from the sharing of knowledge. Therefore, a better and more conscious, what starts to be referred by the scholars to as a knowledge-based collaboration governance framework, for example, is a necessary innovation if organizations are to fully leverage the human interactions enabled by rapidly evolving communication, information, and productivity technologies. This framework has to find a relative balance between incentives to collaborate and the strategic capabilities an organization seeks to obtain against ensuing transactions and production costs. How else can I phrase this? Traditional organizational architecture and related management structures were developed with a primary concern around the control of transaction costs, while paying marginal attention to the benefits of epistemic communities. In spite of the fact that traditional knowledge management has emphasized the importance of organizational culture, in the digital economy, organizations shall create an institutional framework to lay out roles and responsibilities of individuals in a way that integrates collaboration within the fabric of organizational culture, its personnel processes, and management orientation. And as organizations will continue to adapt to capitalize on the digital environment, radical changes will happen in the workplace. For example, a Gartner study already in 2010 mentioned deroutinizing of work, work swarms, working with the collective, simulation and experimentation, spontaneous work, which all point to the need for radical transformation in organizational governance systems that will leverage on the unused potential for innovation which the digital environment opens. Now, let me elaborate on this a bit more. A major constraint to enabling increasing returns for organizations from the digital economy relates to the condition that the combination of time, attention, and talent are the key scarce resource. Time is bounded, which constrains the number of things that people can pay attention to. And therefore, the quality of attention and talent given to the work at hand are the key valuables that should be the primary focus on how we design how work is done in order to productively use the highest quality of attention and talent or expertise for appropriate work. And this requires governance guidelines or principles that enable the agile programming of roles and accountabilities of people, which is important, if not more so, than the attention placed on the management of resources and activities by which we usually manage our organizations, which is inherited from the industrial society. So let me give you an example of successful governance guidelines. And this comes from Google, who decided to keep this time space in the business model for experimenting. So Eric Schmidt, Google's executive chairman until last April, he was actually Google CEO, he stated, and I cite from him, "We put in a system of mechanisms for innovating. And this is a so-called 70-20-10 system. This was a principle that everyone should spend 70% of their time on their core job, 20% as part of another team, and 10% of something simply blue sky, which was often honored in name more than the event. So he says, I've heard from insiders that if you've got a critical job and a tight deadline, you don't give it up at that 70% mark. It was, however, a good way for people to see projects all around Google and test them against their own ideas. You also probably need to tolerate a certain level of waste, which people should start calling learning and experimentation. It is important to keep trying things. You need an unregulated market, a common platform people can work off, a fast iterating model. I end the citation. So what does this mean? Let's frame it now in terms of governance. Governance requires an institutional framework, which consists of power structures, specifying decisioning and governance processes, property rights structures that define incentives and accountabilities, and socio-cultural structures of norms and conventions, defining informal incentives and expectations. This will need to be redefined in the context of the transformative forces of the digital environment. There is an increasing body of knowledge about distributed cognition, where knowledge is not only confined to our individual minds, but embodied collectively. What can be managed in relation to knowledge are the organizational conditions which shape the complex communicative and working relationships in which people can engage, and that enable knowledge to be exchanged, and where information can be useful as a meaningful and accessible repository of external memory. Creating and stewarding an appropriate culture that can fully harness human knowledge or capital for the challenges of 21st century means more self-directed collaboration, ensuring that knowledge flows from where it is to where it's needed. And this cannot be controlled like we control the flow of resources in the industrial society. In a recent speech, Canada's human resource officer, Daniel Watson, referred to such transformations of the workplace as Workplace 2.0. So let me cite from this remarkable speech. He said, we'll provide employees with the technologies that will easily allow them to work from another desk or location whenever their work requires it, and we'll ensure that they have access to the Web 2.0 and social media tools that can break down silos, challenge institutional norms and processes, and share knowledge. Third, we'll change the way we work by experimenting with more nimble workforce models that will allow our knowledge specialists to contribute where and where when they're needed rather than only where they're located. This could include, for example, forming flexible dynamic groups to work on specific projects as required. Well, such measures, or policies if you want, can lead to the development, so I ended the citation, of course, can lead to the development of an organizational and interorganizational commons, which draw on the more dynamic flows of blogs, wikis, as well as pools of human capital, referred to as well as cloud labor, talent commons, from which crowdsourcing and hyper-specialization provide new principles for designing how some types of work can be accomplished. Other forms of commons could also be considered, like more traditional industrial ones, such as equipment, facilities, accommodations. But we will have to restructure those in terms of enabling collaboration and self-organization. For example, there's a company called Valve, which develops video games, which have decided to put wheels, so their desks are on wheels, so everyone can move the desks around and join any projects which they feel they can contribute best at. So they have already enabled an environment for stimulating collaboration and self-organization and empowering their people to decide for themselves where they can be best contributors. So from this perspective, we can regard the organizational transformation in the digital economy from the perspective of fostering a knowledge common by leveraging the digital environment and developing an institutional framework which can create the requisite working conditions that empowers the knowers to self-organize and create, you know, accountable action. So in terms of the policies, this is not a new endeavor. I mean, Nobel laureate Elinor Ostrom, yes, she has done this work on governance of the commons already in the 60s. There is a long tradition of humans developing diverse institutional arrangements for the governance of common resources and avoiding system collapse. Because, of course, you would think, if I let my people self-organize or do whatever they want without any direct control, they may simply not do the job I need done. But, you know, this self-organization actually shows me and can give me the feedback of which are the really meaningful projects in my company. So in this regard, Ostrom has identified 8 design principles that can help to maintain a stable local commons resource pool. And situations where the principles were lacking have proven that to lead to either the tragedy of self-interest or the imposition of inefficient centralization. So I will only name 2 of the principles which actually are most relevant from the digital economy perspective. Like, for example, developing the appropriate incentives to encourage learning, knowledge sharing, teaching, and innovation. Or implement collaboration spaces that are outside of the physical and digital security perimeters to facilitate easy exchanges with potential partners and stakeholders. And this actually reflects very strongly what Canada's chief human resource officer was saying in his speech. So, you know, coming back to your initial question, which are the policies that enable this organizational transformation in the digital economy? Organizations can start with goals such as enable and guide a collaborative culture in which all employees are responsible for the knowledge they learn, embody, and share. And only they can engage and commit to collaboration. Improving the opportunities for self-directed work, pursuit of mastery, and providing what only they can give, their unique talents and abilities, that will engage intrinsic motivation and will increase the sense of purpose and commitment to attaining personal and organizational effect.
So that's really interesting. And how do you see all of the things that you talked about sort of integrate into, you know, all of the social change that's occurring, this sort of wide proliferation of social media, blogs, and sort of this very flat, no boundary corporate and country structures that, you know, sort of the internet has enabled?
Well, we can regard this from the perspective of increasing performance and, of course, stimulating innovation. So Google-like policies, which I mentioned with this 70-20-10 rule, which gives people time to think freely and come up with new ideas. Blue sky. So such policies engage and enrich the intrinsic motivation of people. They better institutionalize multidisciplinary and cross-jurisdictional teams and work so that innovation becomes embedded in work. You see, this is a very subtle process which enables the knowledge flow and increases the likelihood that people encounter what they did not know, new perspectives, ideas, and possibilities. Knowledge cannot be coerced. Can only be volunteered. So that is the thing which I learned throughout my academic career. I mean, you cannot force a PhD student to write a great thesis unless he is really intrinsically motivated and he feels that only he can contribute to that particular topic. And, you know, I always expect my PhD students to know much more than me at the end of the, and I hope also in the beginning, but definitely by the time they have written their thesis. So you cannot have top-down policies stimulating knowledge exchange. You have to give people the freedom to do it. Now, keeping human efforts aligned while simultaneously promoting agility and innovation will require more types of permissionless or self-directed collaboration within increasingly complex environments. To do this is a more challenging task than undertaking one or more re-engineering of the organizational structure. It's not motivating people because I installed one more, let's say, football table in the coffee room. It's a different kind of motivation. So to steward organizational culture towards innovation, collaboration, and trusted relationship relationships. Organization can, for example, seize moving and transformation initiatives as opportunities to reconceive physical and social arrangements. They can, for example, develop frameworks, methods, and analytics to better monitor and steward the culture of learning and knowledge sharing, as I was saying. They can structure work and career paths to include more opportunities for multidisciplinary, transjurisdictional, and other forms of experiential collaborative learning with clients and stakeholders, internal and external to the organization. Or they can provide employees with immersion with clients, experiential learning, and so on.
And I guess, you know, there's almost 7 billion mobile subscriptions out there. There's going to be something like 1.7 billion smart device shipments. I mean, just this year, there's nearly 3 billion users of the Internet, representing about $3 trillion U.S. dollars in commerce this year. And you have this sort of African continent, which is embracing mobile technologies in many ways. So you have a sort of a highly educated kind of component within the global economy and the world, and then you have those who aren't so highly educated who may not get all of that formal education. You know, what is the impact of all of this? If you don't have the education and yet you have access to all of this technology, are you able to embrace these policies in some way? Is it going to impact you, or is it going to be, are you going to be left out?
Well, of course, this is a big pain. Well, people call it the digital divide, of course. I've been teaching courses in communication and studies since, you know, 20 years, which emphasize, even before the digital environment was considered by organizations, which already started to shed light of what's going to come, yes, which is this digital divide. And it's obvious that we have to prepare this already for the new generation. And the United Nations, of course, is making big efforts in this regard to bring more equality in the digital world. And so, you know, the knowledge societies, this principle, of course, is now, I can say that, you know, we find out that it was a dream, and it's still a dream, and it's still unfulfilled. Not only because we think of it in terms of the industrial economy, but also because much more has to be done to invest in those parts of the world in order to bring them up to speed with the technology. So that is not an easy thing. Yes, a lot of organizations now and companies. So yesterday I received a message from Intel, which is actually working on a project empowering girls to deal with technology, and asking me if I want to get engaged in this. So obviously the awareness is there and efforts are starting to be made, and I really hope that this will happen sooner than later, because otherwise we cannot really fully capitalize for our world in the digital economy.
And I guess, you know, what is the impact when you have a situation where, you know, you have Coursera, which is offering all of these sort of free courses, or edX, this kind of new consortium founded by MIT and Harvard.
Yes.
And there's more universities joining these sort of consortiums, and there's many more free courses being offered. Or the experience of, you know, Stanford, they do an artificial intelligence course. 160,000 students around the world enroll in the course, and it's translated into 44 languages, but it's done freely through social media. And, you know, and what's the impact of, you know, these massively open online courses, where are people going to be applying for credits, and what does that mean to the education space? And because of all of this is going to be made available, you know, what is that, how is that going to affect the digital economy when anybody can access material, gain all sorts of expertise, and not necessarily be credentialed anymore?
Yes, so of course this is part of the radical transformation of education. There is radical transformation of all areas of society, not only governance, as I started to mention, but of course education, medicine. So this is what I call the ICT revolution. And I started a big conference called the IT Revolutions in 2008, which was the year that was called and considered the year of no return. So 2008 was kind of declared as there's no way back. We have to embrace the IT revolution or, you know, else. So we continue looking into, and we're still not sure if it will be a bloody or a velvet revolution, because definitely ICT, so this is the latest information communication technologies, are creating a big revolution in the world, in all aspects. How are we going to embrace it, and are we prepared, or can we prepare better in order to benefit fully, or we will just simply be dislocated by the young generation who are going to create their own rules, and then if we are not ready, we will be left behind. So I'm working with several groups, for example, for education, yes, but not only for education. There are other questions as well, but now because you mentioned education. I have a meeting in New York with a government lab from the New York University, which started a project sponsored by the MacArthur Foundation called Making Engagement Work, along the same lines which I mentioned before. And one of the questions which I will bring to the table is exactly this. So why don't we have personalized curricula already? Yes. Why don't we use the power of the digital environment to have every student choose which courses they want and get credentials for that? When we have access to it, when we have a repository of courses, as you mentioned, the MIT, Stanford, and we start to have examples. So one of the reasons is that, for example, in case of the Stanford artificial intelligence professor who did exactly what you mentioned, he had many students from all over the world enrolled in his course, and they took the course and they passed, but they couldn't get credit for it. Of course, the institutions which exist, the industrial society institutions, will hold to their power on the last mile of the industrial society as much as they can, because it's not easy to give up this power. So they will need some time. Processes need to be remodeled. We do not have the framework yet. We do not have the criteria to evaluate students according to what they think is useful for their own career goals. We only have industrial one-size-fits-all models in education, same in medicine, and this is really a bit tragic, I would say, because it keeps our society still stagnant, and that's why we cannot resolve other issues which are fundamental, like global challenges and so on and so forth. So it works, I mean, the old models work as barrier to the innovative ways of the information society or knowledge society.
Now, earlier we talked about, the policies required for organizational transformation in digital economy, and you gave a superb sort of answer to that question. And I just want to take that further now. How do the policies impact performance and innovation?
Well, as I was mentioning, an institutional framework is a human-made creation whose function is neither automatic nor natural. So it has those kind of rules and frameworks under which it has to function. So it therefore must adapt to changes in technology, information, and human capital in order to continue to function optimally, exactly what I was just mentioning before. So our institutions, which have been created in the industrial society, must find a way to adapt to the changes that the information society require. The classical managerial decision and leadership institutional framework is significantly challenged when called on to effectively and efficiently deal with complex problems or to seize rapidly emerging opportunities for and of innovation. And therefore, yes, we need to do something about it. So one thing which we can do is to start to rethink organizational practices in terms of the digital economy. Just as I mentioned before, we need new metrics and models. So the functional and institutional discontinuity between industrial and knowledge societies covers a wide range of specific elements, including the basic nature of the way value is defined and accounted for. This means that, for instance, traditional indicators of economic growth and social status are misleading. Progress in determining policy agendas that are not just convergence or catch-up roadmaps to existing industrial societal systems cannot happen without the invention of new models of what is considered societal wealth, such as learning and how to account for it. Well, such conclusions and such a kind of awareness is important because it helps to explain the lack of progress in developing and diffusing knowledge, society activities and institutions, and why we haven't capitalized yet on the knowledge society promise, which is exactly the expectation is that this will stimulate innovation. So from an action perspective, this points directly to the need to develop much more nonlinear policies around the world to explore the different meanings of non-industrial knowledge society, as you mentioned, in different parts of the world, because there's still an uneven distribution of the tools which are fostering the knowledge society around the world. So besides these new policies and methods, yes, we can reimagine also rights and values, because the current policies fail to open up new avenues for property rights, privacy, identity, and even payment and transaction systems, which are protecting the existing systems and inhibit the emergence of the knowledge society practices and institutions. As I was giving the example, of course, in education, as you rightfully pointed before. So, I would phrase this actually in much larger terms, like reengineering governance and democracy itself, because actually the information society, the knowledge society, is opening roads for governance and democracy, because for democratic actually action, because it is accessible to anyone and it can engage everyone, or it should be accessible to anyone. It's not yet, of course, in some parts of the world they do not have access, and I can relate to this pain pretty much because as I mentioned, yes, so I was born in Romania, and of course technology there didn't reach as fast as here in North America. So I know I've been part of the struggle somehow of, not having access to information, and I know how debilitating that is. So in terms of what the ICT revolution can do for reframing this knowledge society, it can be summed up in many ways, including rules as simple as from knowledge-based education to, let's say, thinking-based education. Because now I can be accountable for myself and decide what courses are really useful for what I want to do in the future, versus having to regurgitate some knowledge which I will never use because I want to do something else in life. But I need to take this diploma in order to do it. So I can create my own curriculum. From long analysis to fail fast, yes, from result-oriented management to initiative-oriented management, from few successes well-planned to many failures and successes through this experimentation with the digital environment offers, from process management to change management, from following the rules to breaking the rules. But our children are not taught in school to break the rules. We are teaching them, of course, to be unregimented and in the system and to follow the rules, otherwise we will fail them in school, we will fail them in everything else, and we will point to them as bad examples if they have too much initiative. So it's our desire to control. It's what I would call our poor imagination, rooted in extrapolative futures, standing in the way of the emergence of the knowledge society.
It's interesting you talk about I guess accepting change on a sort of a rapid basis, being very what I would say would be agile, and also this sort of aspect of embracing failure in that it allows agility and it allows innovation. I guess I'm just thinking of Steve Blank as sort of a kind of a renowned now in the entrepreneurial space about something called customer development, which is that anytime you have a startup, you test whether what the problems are, make sure you understand what they are. You repeatedly test the solutions that you're offering to those problems. You're constantly taking an iterative process of going out to your clients, to your customers, to get feedback, and only after you understand the problem of going to your customers, getting feedback, only by understanding that when you've understood the solution to the problem by going to your customers and testing feedback, by building something called minimal viable products, so just the bare minimum to ensure that feature set is meeting the needs of your clients or of your potential customers, then you proceed to develop a more sophisticated product by continually iterating, being very agile in your development, not spending any money, all of that kind of stuff. It's interesting that that kind of attitude is embraced, for example, in Silicon Valley, but what about countries like China, which maybe has a culture that is not so accepting of failure in the sense of, in the Silicon Valley sense, where it's good to fail, it's good to try things many, many times, it's good to iterate, to be agile, but we're in different cultures that is not so widely accepted. What do you do in those countries?
Well, it's very nice that you mentioned China, and very kind of you, but Silicon Valley and a few other parts of the world are very unique in their approach, and of course we, and when I say we, I mentioned my role as advisor on, science, technology, and innovation councils around the world, including in Canada, where I worked until 2011 on the Science, Technology, and Innovation Council. Well, I can tell you that you don't have to go to China to find those examples. In Canada, we had the same dialogue. How do we stimulate our society, our industry, to accept failure, to actually invest those 10% or 20% of their revenue in trying new things, even if they fail? So this is not an easy matter, especially not for economies which are based on commodities and which are based on resources, and which are doing very well without needing to embrace risk and innovation. So how do you stimulate such economies? I'm part of a group which actually is looking at this from the perspective of foresight. And we had a recent discussion in which we debated, of course, and there are many studies of, for example, the Canadian economy, and why isn't Canada more ready for embracing innovations, and why there's not much done to increase productivity and to bring new stuff and to invent new stuff in Canada. And this is exactly because of how we think, and because, first of all, we, and I say we because I'm Canadian, so I was born in Romania, but my career brought me to Canada, where I spent most of my career. So it is because we don't need to. We have everything. We're doing very well. So, innovation and the drive for doing something is most of the time sparked by a certain need. And, it all depends on the conditions in the particular part. I agree that in Silicon Valley, let's say, there's people who have this drive and they just want more and so on and so forth. But in countries like China, where people do not have any interest because they know everything is planned and they're going to have the same salaries even no matter how much they work and so on. So there's not much incentive there to be innovative. In Canada, because it's such a rich and blessed country with so many resources, of course, it's very similar. Yes, why, if we're doing so well, why would we need to struggle and push to innovate and discover new things? So, it's also probably somewhere intrinsic in the way in which we are brought up. We are raised to think in terms of success, in terms of, okay, I'm going to do well at this and at that. But this and at that and the indicator of success in our education system are not those that stimulate, as I mentioned, the creative economy. We are actually creating standardized human robots that can work well and productive in factory or office jobs in which they just need to do certain standardized tasks. And the better they do them, and the less creative they are, the less headaches I have, and then, you know, the more productive I become for a certain kind of economy. And this is, again, the industrial economy. We do not raise, we do not create those humans, those people who will be able to make the best of their talents and abilities in an open society, this open knowledge society which the digital environment is creating now. That would be my take on your question.
Okay, now let's expand this dialogue into how do you mitigate global challenges in an interdependent world?
Well, of course, today, I will give an answer from the perspective of the digital economy. I will just, if you allow me, just imagine that everyone around the world has access to the technologies, to the potential that the digital environment opens. So with this said, I'm going to, first of all, frame this, which requires mainly, of course, a global challenges. They require a transdisciplinary approach. It requires global collaboration, an open innovation approach, which is facilitated in the digital economy by the easy connection brought about by cheap devices, modular content, and shared computing resources, which are having a profound impact on our global economy and social structure. And they can indeed have even a deeper impact if we will manage to bridge the digital divide, as you rightfully pointed. So individuals increasingly take cues from one another rather than from institutional sources like corporations, media outlets, religions, and political bodies. The digital environment enables each individual to create networks and think tanks addressing global problems. So I'll give you an example, which is a friend of mine called James Grayson. He's a specialist in global whole systems change. And he, imagine that, right? So he founded the global revival think tank called Blindspot. You can Google it, Blindspot, for collaborative development of systemic policy options capable of working at sufficient scale and speed to address problems which range from security to economies of scale and climate. He also created and leads a major international collaboration of 500 system thinking experts and enthusiasts. Imagine how could anyone create that, where to find them, and how to find them if the digital environment won't exist. So this is what the digital environment enables, to bring together 500 system thinking experts and enthusiasts. So this think tank is called Fixing Systems, Not Symptoms. This network uses the web platform Wise Earth to allow wide participation in designing and inspiring radical change in the rules and paradigms that determine whether things will get better or worse everywhere. Of course, these are very generic and very broad and very dramatic goals. But so was your question. Yes, how can we address global challenges? Well, the world is ready, and if we are to assemble a network of experts, as you can see, one person can do it now using the digital environment. This is a repository and a glue which joins like-minded people, you know, at the fraction of an email, if you want. So James is involved in some programs in which I work as well. That's how I met him. Such as the European Union-funded Global Systems Dynamics and Policies Network. But he's involved in many other initiatives, such as NATO Science for Peace and Security Program, United Nations Climate Neutral Network, and the UK Sustainable Development Panel, and so on. So this is what the digital environment enables us to do, to get involved and to create our own networks if we want to really address a problem which we feel it's burning. Another significant example, which I came across through my work as an academic, is the network fostered by the MIT Climate CoLab, which aims to harness the collective intelligence of thousands of people from all around the world, of course, the ones who have access, as you mentioned, so let's not forget the others still, that they cannot participate in this game, But those who can, yes, they are open to participate in the MIT Climate Collab to address global climate change. So anyone can join the Climate Collab online community and participate. They are very open, and they engage in discussion with everyone who is interested. I tried this, and my students too. And community members are invited to submit and comment on proposals outlining what they think should be done about climate change. So we have proposals from individuals as well as from very well-established organizations like MIT, Stanford, and so on. But also from one individual, just like James Grayson. Yes, he can submit a proposal and win. And in some contexts, computerized simulation models project the environmental and economic outcomes of the proposed actions. So I was invited, so that's how I am aware of it, as an expert to review and evaluate such proposals. And both experts and community members select the most promising proposals. So it's a very interesting and democratic process in selecting the proposals. So experts have a say, but it's not everything. It's 50%, and the rest of the community members have a say. And then the most promising are, from both perspectives, are selected. The most recent annual contest was in 2011, and it addressed the topic, how should the 21st century economy evolve, bearing in mind the risks of climate change? That was such an exciting ride to review these proposals and see so much creativity and enthusiasm and the potential for things which we could not imagine. Winning proposals came for teams with members in the U.S., Nigeria, India, and Australia. And in January 2012, representatives of the winning teams presented their ideas in briefings at the United Nations in New York and the U.S. Congress in Washington, D.C. So, you see, as individuals and communities communicate, organize, and take actions, governments and the governance models that have been taken for granted for so long are coming under pressure. Now, we do not need, yes, the international panel on climate change, the IPCC, to decide, what to invest and when to invest in changing the course of the global economy. We have the citizens engaged. The internet and the global economy, real-time news, and an explosion in actors and stakeholders are among many factors and challenge political processes as never before. The governance stage is now crowded with nations, stakeholders, communities, and others, which are, fighting for a role and for recognition. And such innovative linkages among diverse but aligned stakeholders and communities are bringing change to existing governance and engagement models and are forcing governments to adapt the way they interact with all players, from the local citizen like James Grayson, to geopolitical partners, and of course, respected academic labs like the MIT Climate Collab on the world stage. So there are some lessons, which can be learned from such pioneers to mitigate global challenges in our ever-interdependent world, such as stimulate and create channels for multi-stakeholders participation, develop scenarios with all the stakeholders, ask the right questions. That's again, yes, ask the right questions. Because we still are trying to solve the problems and to frame the knowledge society by thinking in terms of the scarcity of resources. So in terms of the industrial society. We ask the questions from that perspective, which keeps us stuck. Yes, we cannot answer the right questions. So do not try to predict the future. Again, that's a very hard one because of how we're trained and because we humans are trained, as Ray Kurzweil mentioned, to think linearly while society develops exponentially and especially technology develops exponentially and gives our world the opportunity to also develop exponentially. So when we think about the future, it is very hard, if not impossible, to actually predict it. And as such, believe it or not, it is prediction itself, the act of predicting the future, what constrains our imagination. And this is one of the major obstacles in the way of governance and why our governments are ineffective in actually leading us to a desired future. Well, this in turn would require us to train the foresight muscle, and that is a new discipline which now the United Nations is also putting on their agenda. So I was last month, actually, I was in Paris at a meeting of the United Nations in which the new foresight directorate is setting up activities like foresight lectures, educational activities around the world to train us to better cope with the knowledge society in terms of thinking about the future and asking the right questions, thinking about the future from the right perspective. So foresight would be a capacity to anticipate various alternative developments, various futures, and of course, as such, appropriate responses in the repositories of possibilities. And we also need to create a space to dream of a future world, if you want. Like, for example, the Epcot Center, the future world that Disney has put together in Orlando, which actually sparks the imagination of children to dream of the future of a clean energy, renewables, sustainable world. We do not have too many such spaces in our schooling and educational system. So, a lot of obstacles in approaching global challenges in spite of the power of the digital economy.
Now, that's a really interesting answer that you provide, and it kind of reminds me of this concept of, you know, like the game EverQuest, and it has 5 million users, and yet it's being used to now model economic behavior, so sort of crowdsourcing of expertise. Or I remember reading about this game called the Folded Game, and they're determining how proteins folded the enzymes, and they're succeeding in 3 weeks where microbiologists and supercomputers have failed, and many of the gamers are in middle school. Or my conversation with Kishore Swaminathan, who sits on a Global Industry Council, which I chair, and he's the past scientist, chief scientist for Accenture. And I remember him talking about this whole concept that boundaries are disappearing, corporate boundaries, geographical boundaries are disappearing, and everything's going to be project-based, and people are going to work from wherever they're located, and it's going to totally disrupt organizations and countries and so on. And then I had a meeting with another member of the Global Industry Council, and we talked about UNESCO, this sort of intergovernmental organization, and we talked about, you know, can it be agile in this sort of very agile oriented world? Or I'm just kind of reminded of this controversy with ITU in Dubai. You know, you have countries who are sort of gearing towards increased governance regulation of the internet, and then you have others who are saying keep it as it is and use these existing structures. So with all of this that you talked about, is there a future for the UNESCOs of the world or the ITUs of the world?
Well, of course, but this all depends of how we're going to embrace it and how soon. And of course, I just want to mention that UNESCO, actually, this foresight directorate, yes, from my visit, I kind of got the impression that they are not supporting enough. They have a bunch of enthusiastic people working there, but they don't have enough resources to actually do something significant. And they have a lot of challenges themselves to that extent. And because you mentioned Folded and so on and so forth, I just want to bring up this, I would say, new concept. It's a recent concept, which is called social computing, which is about, and this is an emerging technology which the digital environment is enabling, which is about to change how we work, how we govern, and how we play. As you mentioned, this Folded game, yes. And social computing and Folded is a very good example of solving a problem by engaging a large network or swarm of people to explore in parallel a problem space and produce a range of effective solutions. And or produce a good or service. So, you know, there are a lot of side effects, I would call it. Sometimes, and I heard this at a meeting, that it's the law of unintended consequences that the digital environment is actually working by and functions by. And, you know, that includes collaborative filtering, online auctions, prediction markets, reputation systems, crowdsourcing and crowdfunded approaches. They are all, they have been enabled without us thinking about, just simply by the digital environment, because it is there. And that is a way in which, you know, the future is now taking us by surprise, because our old way of thinking in terms of the industrial society, in which one person at the top would tell everyone else what to do at each step, is not working anymore. So that can work, that can act only as a barrier in the way of, you know, this multiplayer environments that the digital environment is creating. So these can translate also in a way in, let's say, a need to reframe the knowledge society. So the examples, unfortunately, the examples which I presented are singular. Most organizations do not make use of the full capacity of the emerging digital environment. So one of the important conclusions in recent years has been the inadequacy of the frameworks and variables used to understand and measure knowledge creation and use. And the problem, as I mentioned, and you, of course, agreed, just agreed on that, is that we have been trained to think in terms of the industrial society. So almost a decade ago has gone by since UNESCO has released a seminal publication on knowledge societies, which signals the importance of moving beyond limited information society models of the future. So in 2005, it was already apparent that both culture as a wellspring of innovation and learning as a key source of value meant that knowledge societies are more about education, research, diversity, and access than about bandwidth and hardware. So now the world is even more connected and technology more powerful than ever. But what of innovation, learning, science, diversity, access, as you rightfully pointed? These are dynamic areas of human endeavor, sources of content and interaction. But like all dynamic processes, part of the challenge is to grasp the novel and the emergent. And this cannot be done by the controlling frameworks of the industrial society. Due to lack of adequate policy frameworks, the obstacles in implementing the innovative solutions at all levels are the limited capacity of social processes to manage rapid change in institutional design, planning, and public services that would enable those swarms, like the folded, yes? So you need a certain architecture of participation, so a certain organizational architecture to set it out there and enable the swarms to do their work, like to get engaged in the problem and find a solution. And this, again, yes, requires a new way of thinking. But there's still some work to be done. First of all, until we can frame the problem correctly. And then, of course, until our governments, or if not timely enough, until the digital environment with its unintended consequences will simply do the work by itself.
Now, you've already answered this question through this sort of dialogue we've had already, but I was just wondering if you have additional items to add, and that is, why is it necessary to reframe the knowledge society?
Yes, I mean, this is also, you know, we can look at it from another perspective. And that would be policy leadership, and courage in encouraging experimentation will be the ingredients required to invent the knowledge society of the future. So again, yes, what does this mean besides what I already mentioned, like we don't need to think in terms, or we need to change our way of thinking, and we need to educate the new generation in terms of the information versus the industrial society. So since I already talked about the unusual potential for innovation that the ICT revolution still awaits to fulfill, let us look now, let's kind of enlarge our framework of reference and look at the emergent interconnected grids of communication, electricity, and transport integrated with the social fabric of citizen participants that will unavoidably, yes, unintended or intended consequences, socio-technical systems, if you allow me to call them this way, Will undergird development of this century's energy-efficient and sustainable living, hosting the institution and technologies of transformed low-carbon economies. If only we knew how to understand and advance the interweaving of humans and ICT to create a world with social, physical, and cyber dimensions, enabling a kind of social network operating system with citizens as players and inputs whose interactions use the invisible hand of democratic informed choice to address complex, interdependent global scale challenges such as sustainability and climate change. If only we knew how to enable the deployment of such socio-technical infrastructures while supporting the transition to a post-manufacturing, innovation and knowledge-based green economy and society, we would be in a much better position to address global challenges in our interdependent world. And for this, we need to reframe the knowledge society.
Fascinating. Now, in these two questions, again, these next two that I'm going to ask, we've already touched on many of the topic areas, but I want you to maybe add additional sort of insights and thoughts. And the first question here is on what should the ICT revolution be delivering and why? And again, you did answer many aspects of that. And the second part is why focus on medicine and education?
Well, for the first part of it, for the ICT revolution to deliver on these possibilities, we need first to be able to answer questions such as which governance, I was speaking before, asking the right questions is maybe more important than finding the right answers in this case, because that is what is framing the mindset in order to address these challenges. So questions such as which governance models and structures are appropriate for such socio-technical infrastructures to exploit them or to exploit their innovative potential at its best. What is the role of knowledge governance and social computing in this broader context? What are the principles of management and engineering that will infuse these emerging socio-technical, complex, large-scale systems with the ability to discover a variety of potential solutions in the collective intelligence repertoire to meet future challenges as they arise? How to redefine indicators that expose the impact of the convoluted effects of interdependent social, political, economic factors on the current global agenda, negatively affecting the overall well-being and sustainability of life on Earth? How to define new indicators of wealth and social well-being in a global context? How to increase people's work productivity via engaging mechanisms that stimulate rather than oblige? Transitioning the current work organization processes from contract to commitment by fueling performance through those kind of game-like, visceral, engaging architectures of participation, which, if you want, infuse a blissful, epic-like meaning to the purpose of work, like, fold it, yes, I want to get engaged and use my knowledge to resolve this problem, to find this new enzyme. I can do it. And then I can participate together with the biggest labs in the world and I can have my say in it. And by the way, I don't know if you are aware, but they published this in a very respectable, I think, Science or Nature. And the simple individuals which were not associated with any big organization, any famous Stanford or MIT or, you know, university, when maybe they didn't have any diploma. Simple, the individual, yes, who participated there, was taken and mentioned and co-author to that prestigious publication. Well, how do we do that? And then there's, of course, the low-hanging fruit on which the ICT revolution still did not deliver, which translates into questions such as how to enable remote access to education via e-learning strategies facilitating personalized curriculum. We already mentioned that, yes. Or how to enable e-health and mobile health solutions, empowering patients to get engaged and be accountable for their own health. So, you know, you mentioned the focus on education and health. Because we do not have such, well, they may not sound simple, but they are very simple questions if we look from the perspective of the technology. Because the technology is there, and we do not use it to our advantage to answer such questions for education or health.
Now, all of this is intertwined with your work at the Global Impact Institute. Can you talk about the Global this Impact Institute?
Well, of course, yes. Yeah. So my main passion, and I mentioned also my work with the UNESCO, and now more recently with Governance Lab at New York University, and of course my work with science councils around the world and other organizations and as ICT expert. So my institute is a non-profit organization which actually aims to champion and to accelerate the answer to such questions. So let me give you an example of a project in which my institute is involved, and this is related to the future of medicine. So this project was raised, was a result of a call by the European Commission in a competition which was aiming to put on their agenda five, let's say, of the most important revolutions that ICT could bring. And I was involved in two of these, and I will mention the second one as well. But I want to emphasize my work on the so-called IT Future of Medicine project. I will tell you a bit about it by first framing the problem. So this project emerged from the awareness that in spite of all the progress in biotechnology and computing, medicine is still in what I would call the dark ages. The healthcare sector is in big trouble against a background of extremely successful life sciences with little societal impact and revolutionary ICT that seems to affect all areas of society except for medicine. The idea of personalizing medicine is already becoming increasingly important in all fields of healthcare, yet we are not currently incorporating all the technological innovations that have recently emerged, which could greatly improve our understanding of human health and disease. Medicine receives little support from the life sciences that produces oceans of data that are nicely tucked away in journals or databases. And the problem is that due to the tremendous complexity of the human body, the data cannot be connected in ways that predict how to treat the individual patient if you think in a linear manner, as we humans, as I mentioned, are used to. So we have to use some help, some computational help to process this data. And that's why, yeah, we need certain system that can take into account everything that we can measure to find out what makes each individual different from similar patients. And such data is embedded in our genome, in the proteins, in our blood, in the metabolites, and, it's detailed in images of our body, which we now have access to with the technology, as well as we have access to sensors that can continuously analyze the functioning of our heart or of our organs. And all this data has to be integrated in order to analyze and to be able to respond to each patient's needs, particular needs. So unfortunately, yes, the one-size-fits-all blockbuster drug development industry does not build on this latest wealth of information and possibilities which technology and life sciences have opened. Today, about 80%, let me, give you an example, which is one of the most painful, and I've lost my mother to cancer, so that's why, this is very kind of emotional to me. About 80% of all cancer patients receive medications that will not have a positive impact on their health, while the medication itself produces severe toxic side effects. So 80%! This is due to the fact that every tumor is different and subject to each individual patient's unique characteristics. Such facts have to be taken into account to determine optimal medical treatment on a case-to-case basis. And this is not merely in cancer. The same is true for most other complex illnesses. So we have the technology and we don't use it. So this is a very painful reality. So I can say that undoubtedly the future of medicine is in computing. And of course I got engaged full power in this project, and I'm working with, of course it's a large project, it involves many, and it's a multidisciplinary endeavor, as I was mentioning. So and the other one I was mentioning is the Universal Fabricator, or the Matter Compiler. This is a different project. in which I was engaged, because I truly believe that this is the next step beyond the laptop. It would be the universal fabricator. So the first von Neumann machine was aiming to crunch bits and information, and this is what created the laptop and the mobile technologies now, and, you know, the digital revolution. The next revolution is now going back from bits to atoms and crunching molecules, yes, and being able to fabricate everything by designing a certain DNA of whatever we want to fabricate, and letting the matter compiler create it. Like, you seed what you want, and you can create and produce everything. And nanotechnologies, the advances in nanotechnologies, and the advances in the life sciences are now, you know, bringing, joining forces to enable society to do this, or to dive into this next revolution, if you want. Of course, it's a far-fetched dream, but I believe it will happen, and that is the universal fabricator. Anyway, so that's part of the intellectual endeavors in which my my institute is involved, and mostly with a leadership role, but of course also and mainly in policy work around the world that addresses the immediate needs of reframing the knowledge society that we've been talking about before.
You are a renowned authority in policy and ICT. You have a tremendous success record over many, many years. And from that global perspective, what do you see as the truly disruptive forces over the next 5 years? And why are these choices of yours in terms of being these truly disruptive forces?
Well, I already mentioned a few of them, but there are so many candidates to the supremacy in this list. So I would refer to this in terms of, let's say, short-term, low-hanging fruit, and more far-fetched. And so if I would think about the short-term, I think we already started to see, but we will see much more radical transformations brought about by sensor networks and the social computing, which I already mentioned. In the longer term, I would mention the brain-computer interfaces coupled with nanotechnology, and then there's, you know, others to which we even do not think today, like graphene, which is waiting to impact every aspect of our lives, from artificial blood and tissue to faster computing, foldable TVs, and neutralizing radioactive waste. So let me tell you a bit about each of them. So sensor networks, based on latest advances in nanoelectronics and wireless communications, will undergird a sustainable economy by enabling decentralization of the energy system, which, you know, as I mentioned before, with renewables, which would enable the green economy. So, last but not least, they will revolutionize medicine by enabling real-time monitoring of all our vital functions with alarms and feedback on our mobile devices to keep us on track on living a healthy life, informing us when it is critical to consult a medical doctor, when we have eaten too much sugar and then we have to, or when we have to go for a jog because otherwise our blood pressure will be too high. So such things are, you know, the technologies are there. We just do not apply them because the medical system is not ready, the insurance system is not ready, and so on. But we have to start to plan for such transformation. Then social computing, as we mentioned. So it's changing, I would call it, the modes of production. So, like, for example, the MIT Climate Collab and the Collective Intelligence Center, led by Thomas Malone, they are experimenting with, you know, to fully leverage the digital environment to search for a larger solution space, as I mentioned. So I think, you know, such examples are, and such activities are going to accelerate, you know, reaping the rewards from social computing. The brain-computer interfaces. This is another one which I believe in, and I have a PhD student working on this right now. And a recent project in Canada, which has been funded for this kind of work, they will change the way we interact with our devices by enabling people with disabilities to live a much richer life, for example. They will enable us to sleep better and get better results from limited sleep time when needed by infusing appropriate sleep waves just before wake up. Combined with sensor networks, brain-computer interfaces will help us control our environment just by thinking. Imagine that. And Intel is working on a brain-computer interface that, you know, you can use your computer and open Word documents and so on just by thinking. You do not need a mouse. Imagine how important this is in the first place for people who are paralyzed. They can use a computer with their eyes. Such technologies, of course, they have significantly advanced in the past years, such as, for example, a recent project funded by DARPA at the University of Pittsburgh, which enabled a quadriplegic woman who hasn't been able to use her arms, legs, or any muscles below her neck for 9 years to use a mind-controlled robotic arm to perform actions with an unprecedented level of dexterity. And so she was eating chocolate. There's a video online in which you see her using this robotic arm with her, the power of her mind, to pick up the piece of chocolate and, you know, bite from it and then put the piece of chocolate back on the table. It's fascinating to see such things. And of course, it captures my imagination and my drive to really build such equipment to improve people's life. I want to be a part of that. But it's more than this. It's more to it. So brain-computer interfaces also recently opened the surreal perspective of telepathic communications. For example, a UK scientist, his name is Christopher James, recently experimented with a standard collection of mental information by having his young daughter a part of his experiment. And so he achieved this with electrodes placed against the skull because he didn't obtain permission from his wife to implant the electron in the daughter's brain. Although the technology is there for that. So he developed telepathic brain-to-brain communication. And so he has done an experiment that has proven that this is possible. Isn't that fascinating? I mean, so nanotechnology besides this will enable us the universal fabricator, which I mentioned. And I believe that is one of my, you know, I mean, not that I believe, that is one of my favorite future technologies. And very disruptive. Imagine, I mean, what good any manufacturing company if I can fabricate everything in my backyard? So how much, I mean, you know, as much for the knowledge society, which creates swarms and now disintegrates the industrial organizational frameworks, but the universal fabricators, how much and how disruptive, how much will that change society, how we are organized now, and how disruptive will that be to all the processes? And last but of course not least, let me emphasize a bit the impact of graphene on changing the world beyond what we are capable to even imagine today. So, first of all, let me tell you a bit about graphene itself. So it is the lightest, strongest, most flexible material ever made. It is 200 times stronger than steel, in spite of all this, and could be used to create bendable flat screen TVs that you can roll up and take with you. And it can lead to major breakthroughs in healthcare, such as artificial hearts, artificial blood and long-living brain implants. Since it is just one atom thick and occurs, you know, in a hexagonal pattern, and it's carbon-based, as are all life forms on Earth, graphene can enter the body without disturbing the immune system and without causing harm to body tissue, as silicon and plastic, which we use now, are doing, harming the body tissue. So researchers are today already looking into how graphene could be used to grow human tissue. And the implications, of course, are huge. As I mentioned, from lab-grown human hearts that can last disease-free for 100 years, and imagine how such hearts may one day help children with birth defects and adults with heart disease, or, you know, combating Alzheimer's by inserting graphene electrodes into a patient's brain. which is very difficult today because all the materials are actually dangerous for the human body. So it will allow doctors to use higher doses of new drugs that are lethal to cancer cells without getting a patient sick or harming healthy cells, because it can actually be implanted in the body and targeting the respective cancer cells. But in addition to its healthcare applications, graphene has many other potential uses, such as transistors that will compute at much faster speeds than today's devices, as well as graphene antennas that could make wireless speed 100 times faster. So it could possibly create solar cells in which every photon falling on graphene is converted into an electric current, which will allow solar panels to absorb more light and increase the efficiency of solar energy. And it's also, as I mentioned, amazingly good at absorbing radioactive waste, which will improve cleanup after nuclear accidents and mining and natural gas drilling sites, where natural contaminants often spill into nearby water supplies and land. So it seems like a miracle material with a lot of potential, from long-lasting, faster-charging batteries, much lighter, more fuel-efficient cars, and even lightning-powered skyscrapers that would be made of graphene. And those skyscrapers made of graphene will harness the energy from a lightning bolt striking the building. The unimaginable. So if we now take a step forward, if you allow me to, you know, to dwell more on my imagination, and I would say, yes, we scientists are really romancing with technology and like to be carried away into intangible futures. Imagine that all these advances taken together with brain-computer interfaces enabled by graphene technologies, which, you know, can be implanted since we are children to enable our telepathic interaction. So whatever sci-fi movie you want to create, or universal fabricators of food or medicines coupled with all these graphene properties. And of course, I don't want to think about, and I hope you will not ask me, about the ethics and other issues which all this romantic with technology are raising. And of course, they have to be framed before anything, and we have to be prepared for such technologies with the right questions about ethics and how we want to use such technologies. It's like any technology, yeah, from the knife to graphene, yes, in whatever way, shape, or form we want to use it. It has to be done with a lot of thinking and awareness about both sides of the picture, the positive and, of course, the negative impact which they can have on human life and, in general, on life on our beautiful planet.
In thinking about the brain interface that you just mentioned, I was just wondering if your group, your student, is connected with Gary Birch at the Neil Squire Society.
He is connected to many groups around the world. We are working with Amedeo Danjulli at Carleton University, who is a neuroscientist who has a lot of interesting and controversial research. But as I was mentioning before, and because I actually am a living example of what I preach, how am I to know all those to whom my students, who is specialized in brain-computer interfacing and is writing his PhD on that, how am I to know all the ones to whom he is connected, especially now with the digital environment? I do not ask my student to give me a report of all the ones with who he is connected. I only want to guide and support his work and encourage him, and of course let myself mesmerize by his results and address questions and issues along the way, which, you know, most of the time it's becoming more and more difficult for me to answer his questions, except that I can guide him, maybe ask a colleague or guide him to ask someone else. And so I believe he is connected, but I wouldn't like to be able to, even to be able to answer this question.
And I guess another question I have is, I don't know if you've followed the work of Kurzweil and this idea of the singularity. which some people think is way out there and others embrace it. So have you heard of the work, and then do you have an opinion on it?
Oh, definitely. Not only that I heard of the work, this is more or less my territory, because I'm teaching artificial intelligence. And of course, many of my students, and even at the last time I taught the class, I gave the students the opportunity to choose a project from the field which they would present. And some of them, for example, implemented some computer games with latest agent technology and autonomic agents, and some of them implemented swarms and architectures of participation. But one of the students said, well, I want to write a report about singularity. I just read this book by Ray Kurzweil. And of course, I know him, and I've been to his talks, and he's just such an inspiring genius. And I want to tell you, yes, I believe in his predictions. I know most people do not understand it, and this comes back to what actually Ray Kurzweil preached from the very beginning as an inventor and the technologist and a bright mind who has seen and observed that actually technology evolves exponentially. It follows a power law. It's not linear, and we humans think linearly. So I believe that it's difficult for most of us to believe his predictions. But and he has many, which he predicted, and many of his inventions, of course, have had the impact which he anticipated, because he has this ability to think into the future exponentially. So yes, I definitely believe in the singularity and that it will happen. And you know, we just do not use the right ingredients now, and we do not have our research interdisciplinary enough in order to enable that. So, for example, I was involved and still am involved in a project which is quite unusual in artificial intelligence. So it's called Emulating the Mind. It ended up with in a book, and of course I was championing the idea together with Dietmar Dietrich from the Technical University of Vienna and Mark Solms, which is a very famous Freudian neuropsychoanalyst who actually is reviving, yes, this mind, power of the mind, and how we actually work and how we are driven by memories which we create already in our childhood. And that's why, you know, the emphasis on education and our upbringing and the way of thinking and the frameworks in which we develop, which will have a long-lasting impact. But let me make a long story short by letting you know that, you know, there are many paradigms in artificial intelligence, one more contradictory than the other. But I've been part of this group of neuroscientists, neuropsychoanalysts, and engineers. So we created the first conference and a first workshop on neuropsychoanalysis, and I've been tasked with, I would say, to say the least, the unusual job of leading a workshop and a panel called no more nor less than Silicon in Love. Of course, I was so happy at the opportunity, because I like such, let's call them, crazy endeavors, which push the limits of possible. So, and my colleague on this was Yoram Yovel, who is a very famous psychoanalyst from Israel. So I was in Canada, and I was the engineer on the panel, and Yoram Yovel was the psychoanalyst. So there were very exciting questions, which are published in the book Silicon in Love, the result of this, not Silicon in Love, the book is called Emulating the Mind, and there are a few chapters there, and of course also the video of the conference, including this panel, is available. It's been produced, and I think it's available from Springer. So the conference is, again, if anyone wants to Google this, is a neuropsychoanalyst first meeting of the neuropsychoanalysts and engineers. So questions like, can computers ever develop affection? What does it take to develop affection? And, you know, attachment. For example, one remark during the section was, if I would lose my computer, I would definitely have, you know, an anxiety attack because I'm so attached to my computer. So it's, you know, from our side, yes, but can the computer also develop that? And how do we build machines? What does it take? Which are the answers? Do we need embodiment? Can the bits by itself or information technology without embodiment achieve the kind of thinking or affective-driven action which we human, by which we human or which govern human existence and human action itself? Because no matter how much we would try to build machines following only the logic, how humans tick is not dictated, still not dictated only by the logic. And, you know, I do not think we want that. We want to be driven by our human values, of which I may say, and this is my personal opinion, love is probably the biggest and the strongest drive.
That's really some interesting thoughts you put out, and I guess I'm reminded of Penrose and his writings on this area, or Daniel Dennett, or some of the other people who have thought about, you know, some of the ideas that you've been mentioning here.
On consciousness, yes, of course, and I've been part of, you know, groups which were exploring consciousness. And since my PhD, actually, I've been working with such groups. We had meetings organized by the International Institute of Advanced Studies in Baden-Baden regularly every year. And one of my dearest friends whom I met there, Professor Søren Brier, who is actually in Denmark, and he founded the international journal called Cybernetics and Human Knowing, a journal of second-order cybernetics. He actually pushed such areas as what is consciousness, you know, questions, fundamental questions, what it is and what does it take for us humans to understand ourselves through the lenses of who we actually are and what differentiates us from any other living beings we know. Yeah, and that is, yeah, our own essence, consciousness.
Well, I guess cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, or maybe I am, therefore I think.
Yes. Back to square one. We're definitely not the first ones to think about this. So, you know, I mean, that should be a different conversation, I guess. It's been for as long as we became aware that we can be aware.
Now, you're a giant in the industry, again, a remarkable figure, a famous pioneer in many respects, and you've had many roles in your lives. Can you discuss from your prior roles, maybe share some key lessons or practices that you think would be of value to the audience?
Well, first of all, thank you very much. I mean, I think definitely you are praising me far beyond what I really stand for. So, but of course, I, like everyone along my path, because, you know, I have quite a respectable age, which I do not want, I'm not ready to divulge here. Yes, I learned a few lessons along my path. And, well, with what to start? I would say one of them was already summed up by Einstein. And if my, you know, my pursuits and maybe all what I spoke about now, I think they point to it and reminded me of it. Like, if I had an hour to solve a world crisis, I'd spend 59 minutes defining the problem and 1 minute to solve it. So that's where we are. This is where we are with our world. And that's why the problems don't get solved. That's why the problems do not, the right problems, yes, do not get solved. We look at symptoms, not at problems. We talk about and define symptoms, not the problem. We spend insurmountable amounts of resources dealing with the wrong issues, patching old roads that lead nowhere, reinvesting in solutions that will never work, in futile attempts to make them work. And I have numerous examples of such, of how such, you know, inertia keeps society stagnant. One which comes to mind right now because it's pretty painful. It's I've been, you know, confronted. I mean, I'm part of an NSF call for infrastructure funding. That actually is set such, and there are many other examples, I'm just mentioning this because this is the one I'm working on right now, and the funding is restricted to funding only applications of existing solutions, but they want to apply these existing solutions to new areas. So So I'm struggling. How can I actually write a proposal for such a call? In essence, even if I want to use a new technology that just made it to the market and has proven to work much better in similar applications, I cannot use the funds to use it to accelerate, for instance, the development of a new cancer treatment. And you see, I'm thinking, where would this money go? In the old way of thinking, to solve what? What we already know is not working with those solutions. So it's always becoming the chicken and the egg problem. So, you know, I have numerous other examples which range from the internet and how we keep patching it by keeping the old way of thinking about it versus what it became in the, and you know, how can we use it to reframe the knowledge society, to how we deal with societal systems such as health, education, and global issues, the energy, climate change, sustainability, in which we think linear, we think only from the perspective of one country versus globally, and interdependent and complex, and at least as Ray Kurzweil is still pushing us in terms of exponential development versus linear development. Anyway, one other pretty sad lesson, and unfortunately, why do I choose only sad? It just come to mind now. I hope that the next one, after this one, I'll have something more positive. But one other pretty sad that I learned from my role as a researcher is that there are all sorts of obstacles on the path to international collaboration. Like, if we are to solve global challenges, if we are to attack a problem like the singularity from different perspectives, we need the best expertise from wherever it is available, and we need interdisciplinary experts to work together. Our funding systems do not allow for such large-scale international interdisciplinary research programs. In fact, it is almost impossible to get funding for research that challenges the status quo, since our funding systems mainly target established areas. You have to be established in order, first of all, to have the credentials needed to get funded. And that's what the MIT Climate Collab or games like Foldit are dismantling now. And they offer, you know, examples in which they can prove that there are individuals who are experts without being established, and they are experts in new areas. There's more of those than the established ones who, you know, again, another lesson which is related to this is it's more difficult to unlearn than to learn. So once I learned to think in a certain paradigm, it's almost impossible. I'm already blinded to all the other possibilities. And this is what our funding systems are preventing us from opening up to a world of possibilities, because the ruling of how the funding is distributed makes it impossible to address, for example, even the questions that you posed to me in the beginning of this interview. Yeah, what does it take for organizational transformation in the digital economy? Because what is established is the industrial way of organization, that way of thinking. And those are the questions which they expect and the funding agency. So this is one of the reasons why the IT revolution did not still deliver on its potential, why global challenges are not being addressed to their full potential. Well, a positive one. I think from my role as a teacher, I think, and I see it as a positive one, I do not know. I'm sure that it can raise a lot of controversy by itself, but I think no matter what, as a teacher, you teach what you are. You teach what you are much more than the knowledge itself, which can be found in books, on the internet, or everything else by anyone. So, you know, if you're not passionate about the discipline, if you are not an embodiment of it itself, more than the knowledge you convey, you know, you cannot give more to your students. So they can better stay home and sleep in rather than be at 8 a.m. in class to listen to you, because you cannot help students love or hate a discipline if you are not embodying it. So being a mentor through your own example is much more valuable than preaching from a pedestal. As a teacher, your conduit, the love for the field and dedication to your pupils is what will mold characters as the future contributors that will be applying the knowledge you convey to make this world a better place. And this is what you as a teacher have to do. The rest can be found anywhere else.
You know, those are some pretty important lessons, and I especially like the one about this whole aspect of if you're going to teach with passion, because really everything's available out there, and students need some other engagement model, and you being an embodiment of whatever you're teaching will make that difference. I'm now going to ask this question about controversy in terms of the work that you do. And it's interesting. I mean, you're involved in many different domains. You have almost a dendritic thread out there and multiple fingers in all these different areas that interest you. And as a result, you must be aware of areas of controversy in your work. And you've discussed some of them, I think. But do you want to talk about this more?
Well, of course, there's many controversies, but from the singularity to, of course, all what I mentioned here and dismantling organizations and so on and so forth. But I believe that, you know, as a scientist, and if discovery is at the core of your essence, controversy is just a necessary ingredient. It kind of, you know, goes with the territory. But let me, you know, because you mentioned areas of controversy, I have a few very funny ones, which, I mean, just shows us how hard it is for our essence, you know, to accept change or even, you know, to let go of our territory. So, for example, there has been a big debate since its beginning. As a profession, about software engineering. And I taught software engineering. And, you know, I'm an engineer. I kind of developed my career along with the profession because it's a new, profession. And it's, we do not even know where it started. Yes, because in my university, which was like about 30 years ago where I studied, it was in the beginning of the automatic control, at least in Romania, and we had a department which taught us robotics and another department, and that was dealing with the hardware, and another department which was dealing with the hardware of computers and microprocessors, and another department in the faculty which was dealing with what was called computer science at the time, and they were the software people. So we had both in one, under one umbrella. Software and hardware. So the problem with software engineering is as simple as that. Computers, namely the hardware, needs software. And software, which is the computing and the algorithmics, needs hardware. That is the computers in order to run. So it's a dichotomy. It requires co-development. This dichotomy is embedded in the requirements of expertise for a software engineering profession, which is not easy to locate in a department or another. So legal battles abounded over this since software engineering was emerging as a discipline in the 90s. And because, as I told you, I spent most of my career in Canada, there is a famous example, the Canadian Board of Professional Engineers sued the University of Newfoundland for giving diplomas of software engineering from the computer science department of faculty. And, you know, the conflict was aggravated by the Professional Engineers Society, like of Ontario, which was thinking that, of course, this will mislead the public and affect public health and safety and welfare. Because, you know, the engineering profession itself has certain practices, which, let's say, the computing profession doesn't have. And, of course, we can go on and on. But, you know, the thing is that to write brilliant coding, you do not need to be an engineer. You need talent. You even do not need schooling. I mean, there's so many out there who just are self-taught and write brilliant coding. So, you know, and they can find solutions and do the job. So as a new discipline, computer science did not find its place easily in academia. Computer engineering, I mean, and software engineering as parts of it. So when I was a student, this was taught in the Faculty of Automatic Control, which is an engineering faculty, but in a department called computer science. So... And along my career, I taught in faculties of science. I taught software engineering in faculties of science, in faculty of engineering, in departments named information technologies or information systems. So if you want my opinion, a profession or software engineering is measured by how well you profess it and by the passion that you invest in it rather than by the kind of diploma you carry. Call it coding or software engineering. If you can write brilliant programs that do the job, then I will hire you. Another area of controversy, I think, you know, this one, again, I want to emphasize is this one in medicine, because Why is it controversial? Of course, the revolution that ICT is creating is empowering the patient rather than the medical doctor. So the medical doctor is losing their control of the profession. And of course, with that, of course, also the pharma companies, the blockbuster drugs, which make a lot of money to the industry, but they are ineffective in 80% of the cases sometimes, you know. So this revolution, of course, is very controversial. Many say, well, what does computing have to do with medicine? I just need, like many medical doctors say, I just need to look in the patient's eyes and I know if they are ill or not, you know. So, you know, I mean, there's many kinds of doing medicine. I do not want to contest any of them. And of course, it's not my role. But also, I'm not qualified. But I believe that computing can help a lot, and empowering the patients are going to keep our society healthier than, you know, letting only the doctor deciding by looking in our eyes or by whatever other magic they can tell us if we are ill and what we have. So that's another controversial area. Then there's, of course, the organizational management, which has proven, yes, I mean, even in organizations which have worked forever in a command and control style, like the military or the similarly operated emergency response organization. So we have the so-called incident command management system, which both the U.S. and Canada are using. And it's a rigid structure which does not allow anyone to do anything practically. The system is paralyzed until the chief commander is allowing an action. And it has proven to be ineffective, you know, along the year. I mean, since the 1600s in Austria, there was the so-called Maria Theresa order, which was given to commanders who disobeyed orders, and therefore they won the battle. So, you know, initiative was encouraged, especially because you cannot know everything from the ivory tower of the command where only one person is to decide, especially now, more recently, with the asymmetric attacks, you know, the terrorist attacks, have completely changed the game internationally and the power balance internationally. So the need to respond to such new kinds of challenges or, you know, or unexpected, very rare events such as a tsunami or an earthquake, they need immediate response. If a person is right there and they can rescue someone or they, you know, need to throw their laptop, whatever information is on it, in order to jump in the water or to leave their laptop and the post, to jump in the water to rescue someone, they would be punished by the rules in the incident command system. However, fundamental transformations, which, you know, have been summed up in concepts such as power to the edge, even power to the fringe, which empowers individuals at the edge of the organization to take action when required without approval from the top, have proven necessary, and they are now changing the ways in which we used to do things, even in the most entrenched command and control organizations. So I've done a lot of work to revolutionize emergency management organizations and by introducing ICTs. And one of my projects, which is called Enabling the Self-Organizing Security Network, SOS Network, is now on the agenda of the United Nations Foresight Section. They want to take the lessons from this project and apply it to a broader spectrum, to induce self-organization in other organizations, in our other systems. So, in regard to this, and because you mentioned Ray Kurzweil, we already spoke about how can we anticipate, and can we really anticipate by thinking as we are trained to in a linear manner. So strategic planning versus foresight is another area of controversy, and because I'm working with governments, I know that, you know, it is very hard to bring to the attention of governments that we need a different way of thinking about, you know, the future. where action is needed sooner rather than later if we want to avoid catastrophes such as the financial crisis or future climate-related tragedies. So again, here, Einstein again was, you know, the genius, and a lesson which I think more of us have to remember, and that is things should be as simple as possible, but not simpler. So thinking linearly, of course, is simple and within our immediate repository, but it doesn't always do the job. So when we think about the future, we should try and do our best to remember that the future does not unfold linearly, especially not in the technology-driven society in which we live today. And so anticipation starts to be a discipline, the discipline of dealing with uncertainty, a discipline in its own right, as much as, believe it or not, professional futurist is becoming a real profession. So, of course, nevertheless, a controversial one. So anticipation as a discipline is about approaching the future not as something we know or can plan for or we can even predict, but as an emergent phenomenon, an emergent from a plethora of possibilities which we can create. So what we can create, we can set certain premises. It's called seeding the future so that we enable that particular future to emerge. And how do we do that? Of course, by attuning our educational systems, by creating the individuals which we want to act upon that desired future. Let's say the real knowledge society which we want to flourish. So this brings me to another controversy. I think that would be the fifth one which you asked me to. So in which I'm involved as a thought leader, namely emergent engineering. So I was trained as an engineer, as I mentioned, and in a few respectable schools around the world, I can say, and as such I understand the fundamental conflict when transitioning to the network society, which is driven by all sorts of communication networks, and which create a lot of chaos to an engineering-trained mind, because engineering it's teaching us to actually, that we are capable to control everything around ourselves if we apply some simple rules, and the only way in which we can do that is to tell every object to do what they have to do at each step. So in particular, the sensor networks have opened the possibility to connect physical objects into ecosystems around human needs that can evolve and adapt to these needs. For example, in a smart home where temperature, lighting, and even wall colors or digital paintings are changing as one particular person enters the home, the field is called, intelligent environments. So, it's a part, a subset of artificial intelligence, and it involves distributed artificial intelligence and so on. In the not too far future, synchronizing large networks of transportation with energy demand for electric cars and the limited capacity of roads can be done using the sensor networks, but it cannot be done using the traditional control engineering, which works by the industrial organization top-down paradigm. We cannot tell every car on the road at every step what to do. We have to let the car negotiate with the others in the unfolding a present, which we cannot anticipate at every step. So to meet such needs, a new branch of engineering is currently under research, and that is aiming to deal with the management and control of complex engineered systems. Some call this branch of engineering emergent engineering. Others call it complex systems engineering. Of course, it's still, we have to settle to a name. It doesn't matter. What is important is what does it stand for? And that is, even the controversy over what is complex versus complicated has not been solved yet. So, there's a few more obstacles in the way of this new branch of engineering that will enable us to deploy such large-scale systems, socio-technical, cyber-physical systems. So to spare you these details, I will dive directly into the essence of the paradigm, which requires us to rephrase the classical concept of engineering, design, and systems control in terms of evolvability and emergence found in natural systems rather than controllability and observability, which, you know, the old engineering and control engineering school of thought came up with from more small system science, I would call it. So we have to look at the big system science and at life and how life itself evolves. So emergent engineering approaches self-organization itself as a paradigm for designing, controlling, and understanding complex distributed systems, and fundamentally challenges the traditional engineering school of thought in its core principles. So based on concepts having to do with distributed network multi-agent systems with a variety of purpose-built capacities, such as sensing, reporting, acting, and collaborative, you know, the environment starts to behave like a living organism itself. Emergent engineering then aims at solutions that can be selected through an evolutionary adaptation process to produce progressively better and continuously improving solutions. In contrast to what classical engineering would do, like applying a known static strategy to control a system, which we think it's going to be there always behaving in the same way. So, these are, you know, the biggest controversies in which I am currently engaged and which drive me to wake up every day, and sometimes, you know, they take a bit from my sleep to find the right answers and the right statement. I mean, or phrasing of the respective issue.
It's interesting in your discussion. I can sense the passion that you have. It's delightful, and I would envy the students you have. You know, they must just love working with you, or, you know, because that passion clearly comes through in the fact that you are engaged in so many different areas and you have such deep insights in so many different areas.
And it goes the other way around. I can tell you, like, my students definitely get me passionate about their own passions. Like, in this case with the brain-computer interfaces, that was never on my agenda. Of course, I was always fascinated when I heard it, and I always thought, no, this is not my piece of cake. And one of my best students, my most favorite students, with whom I've been working on other issues such as modeling culture in organizations and developing software that can actually do simulations which can anticipate the effect of a policy on an organization. So no, these are also fascinating topics which are much more in line with my own passions. Well, this student, believe me, has infused his passion for brain-computer interfaces to me. So it's, you know, it goes both ways always. And it is that, you know, that is a reward, an implicit reward of our profession as mentors for young minds, and the biggest joy when we find a young mind that can do it already when we are mentoring them, can embody this passion.
I mean, I can definitely relate. I mean, last year I was asked if I could be a judge at the Global Imagine Cup in Australia, and then prior to that, I was the ASEAN Special Awards Judge at the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair, where they have 1,500 winners from the different regions and countries around the world, and then they compete at the Global Science Fair to choose the ultimate winners in the different categories. And it was just fascinating seeing these very young people demonstrating unique research, creating commercial prototypes, and they've done all the literature search to ensure that their research was unique. And it was quite inspiring and interesting to just watch all the innovation. In your work, have you done any judging like that?
Oh, of course. I've been involved in such science fairs with high schools, and of course, it's just the most rewarding thing. I've been involved in robotics competitions as a judge, and of course, on the other side, also as a mentor for groups. Absolutely, I can totally share your feelings and enthusiasm at being a part. You know, it shapes you also as an individual. Although you've been there, done that, but when you see it again and in the new generation, this is at least for me what fuels my drive and to really work as a mentor. And it also is, it's a positive feedback is a reinforcement. It keeps us young at heart and at mind.
I just remember one conversation with a fellow judge from Intel. He was a senior research scientist, and he indicated he was talking to one of the finalist students at the this Intel Science and Engineering Fair in the physics category, and the student had developed a series of attempts at creating an atomic microscope and finally succeeded. But he said it was just fascinating, you know, something that would probably cost millions in their labs to create. This student was doing for something like hundreds of dollars. And then he got into a sort of a discussion of quantum physics with the student, because that was his background, and that is the Intel researcher. And he said, I could not distinguish whether I was talking to somebody in my lab or this student who was like 16 or 17 years old. And he said it was just a fascinating experience.
Yes, which brings us back to what I was mentioning. Yes, the individual and participation. And that's what we can really leverage through the digital environment. The engagement of such minds and such passion and the talent in solving big problems. And of course, I came across many brilliant minds along my career, and some of them I could help, some of them I could not, because they just didn't have the credentials to get involved in solving a particular issue and get funded for that. So we still have a lot of barriers and obstacles. And what I call this residual, which we carry with us from the institutional frameworks that we have created, and we can rethink those to involve, to leverage engagement. So again, coming back to the meeting which I will attend in New York in at the end of the month on making engagement work and how to capitalize on the digital environment for it.
We're down to our last three questions, and these ones are sort of outside of the different kinds of areas that we've talked about so far. And this first and the last three that I'm going to ask is about computing as a profession. And that is, you know, we have accounting, medicine, law, engineering that you already talked about. So do you feel computing should be a recognized profession on par with things like accounting, medicine, and law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials?
Well, I already touched on this a bit, you know, on computing and software engineering, or, you know, however we want to call such pursuits of processing information. And, you know, I'm surprised at the question, first of all, because all along I thought it's a recognized profession. And because, of course, I'm a member of the Association of Computing Machinery, of the IEEE Computer Society, and, for example, ACM, yes, obviously, is recognized widely as the premier membership organization for computing professionals. So, you know, it's like, it's not a recognized profession. I mean, what is the question about? So what I know as an academic is that in most universities, a Bachelor of Computing degree is usually conferred upon a student after 4 years of full-time study. And this includes computing studies, although generally a large focus is put on the integration of computing with one of science, business, liberal arts, or, you know, engineering applications. So, although the Association for Computing Machinery was founded in 1947, of course, computing as an emerging discipline and, you know, much in sync with how, what we spoke with the ideas that aligned with what we already discussed about the knowledge society and the information revolution. Computing is still searching for its identity as a profession, because the ICTs themselves, as technologies, are ever evolving from algorithmic pursuits as they were meant to be, yes, translatable into software to automate processes and production machines when computing first appeared in the industrial society, to the large-scale networked applications of the kind which I just mentioned, integrating communication networks with transportation and energy networks. So since computing is now pervading everyday systems and infrastructure and will continue to revolutionize organizations and governance structures, it's been somehow assimilated into the respective disciplines as, let me say, the necessary disruptive evil. So mastering the IT revolution is not easy. And if computing is the means, of course, that's the necessary evil now. So specialists are needed, and they are mostly self-taught, since our traditional curricula do not cover such skills and ways of thinking, as I mentioned. Moreover, new disciplines continue to emerge under the computing umbrella, such as social computing, as I mentioned. For example, in 2010, I was called by Springer, together with other computing luminaries or revolutionaries, if you want, if I may, to revive the world, the old Springer journal with the name Computing. And I was involved in redefining its course as area editor for bio-inspired computing, which is again an emerging area in line with the needs for emerging engineering and for computing paradigms that can enable the large-scale communication networks to act as controllers of society and the economy as large. So my career evolved together with the profession. I can say I'm a living, breathing example of how it developed. I'm a systems engineer, trained in hardware in an automatic control department, so not in software, with a PhD in systems diagnostics in which I applied computing to make, to design an intelligent system that can diagnose other systems. So it was kind of an artificial intelligence system. My first job was in an information technologies department. Then I taught in a school of engineering science. Actually, I didn't teach, I was a postdoc. I taught very little, but I did my postdoctoral training in engineering science. Then I taught in mechanical and manufacturing engineering. I've taught information technologies there, and actually information technologies targeting the industrial society. Then I taught in electrical engineering, and finally in the Faculty of Computer Science. And now I am in the School of Information Technologies. So, you know, this reflects the wide range of applicability of computing as a profession. These societies for computing professionals, such as IEEE Computer Societies, the Canadian Information Processing Society, they can help the computing professional identify appropriate preparation, practices, and continuing development, but it is the professional's responsibility to establish their own trustworthiness. One of the difficulties facing a possible computing profession is the diversity of professionals that are employed in computing. And some of the applications are mission critical, such as writing, testing, verifying, and maintaining the code used to control a nuclear power plant, or establishing and maintaining our telecommunication network, or even selecting and configuring or installing and maintaining the services provided by a suite of enterprise resource management modules to run Walmart. So the variety of these applications points to a variety of professionals with non-uniform backgrounds and schooling. As such, although generic code of ethics could be shared, as you mentioned, yes, it is very difficult to define a meaningful common body of theoretical and practical knowledge mastery of which, you know, we can decide that are prerequisites for a practice as a computing professional. So we have to operate our profession by the same means and with the same dynamics which ICT opens from an open innovation perspective that enables us to keep pace as the profession itself will continue to evolve and embrace new fields and areas of exploration. That's my take on it.
Now we're down to the last two questions. And again, you are this iconic figure in the industry worldwide, acknowledged for expertise in many domains. You have this remarkable history that you just talked about as well. So from all of this, from your extensive speaking, travels, and work, do you have any stories that you could share?
Oh, my. I'm not sure if you're ready to listen to my stories. They abound, you know, ranging from a broken leg in Helsinki Airport on my way to give the next keynote in Orlando, which I gave in a cast, to detention on Miami Airport when I still had my Romanian passport, since the embassy forgot that I had to return from Brazil, where I was giving another keynote, on the same route via Miami. So I only received a one entry visa. So when I returned, they said, why are you in the United States? I was in transit. And yet, because I had to wait 17 hours, I had to wait in a special small room in the airport. I felt in detention anyway. So Let me choose some more, let's say, inspiring stories, because the way you phrase the question with me as this whatever iconic figure, which I definitely do not see myself at, but, you know, obliges me to give more interesting and inspiring stories. So, for example, I was on a travel. One of my first travels after I received my diploma, my engineering diploma in Romania. And that was in Tallinn. It was the only place where we Romanian at the time could travel. Yeah, we could only travel to within the old communist bloc. And luckily enough, although I have submitted my works before to the International Federation of Automatic Control, and they were published, and my papers have been accepted to be presented at conferences, but I could not travel there. Like the conference before this was, they were held every 4 years, so the one before this, the Congress was in Munich, so I couldn't go. But in Tallinn I could travel, so luckily I also, the company for which I was working at the time sponsored me to go to Tallinn and present my work. So it just incidentally, yes, the head, the chair of the session to which I made the presentation was Professor Rolf Iserman, a very famous professor of control engineering. And of course, I was very nervous about making the presentation. So I presented, and incidentally, yes, at the reception, I bumped into him and saying hi. So he said, he just, you know, threw a question. And he said, well, that was very interesting what you presented. Would you like to come to my lab and develop your ideas in a PhD? So I was a young mother of two babies at the time, and I can tell you that question, not only that it changed my life, but I mean, speaking of, I could not envision such a future. For me, it was an impossible future. Obviously, I couldn't even travel to Germany, to West Germany at the time. So, but it got me thinking, and luckily, after this conference, the communism was abolished in Romania, so I remembered the question. And of course, I wrote to this professor immediately, and the rest is history. My PhD was done under his supervision. So that's one travel story. Another story which is also interesting, and it also kind of shaped my career, it's also travel related. I got my first job at Brunel University in London. And how I did that, it's again, during another travel, so I was presenting my work. I was a PhD student in Germany at the time, and I submitted my work to a conference, and the conference was in London. So I had some friends in London who invited me on that occasion. It just happened that there was a Croatian wedding going on, and I was invited by these friends. Well, let's go. I want you to, you know, to introduce you to my other friends. So I went to this wedding after my presentation, and I was looking around. Everybody was speaking Croatian. I am Romanian. You know, I didn't. That's one of the languages which I don't speak. So I've just been looking around, and I saw another person who was looking around and kind of felt lost. So I went to him, and I asked him, are you Croatian? And he said, no. So then we started to speak in English. I said, okay, well, at least I have someone to talk to while these people are having a good time in Croatia. And he told me he was the head of information systems department at Brunel University. And I told him, well, I'm Romanian. And he said, well, we don't have any Romanians in our department. And of course, I was telling him about my work and my PhD, probably with a similar passion as I'm sharing my ideas with you now. And so he said, why don't you, when you go back, why don't you send me your CV? So the rest is history. I got my first job at Brunel University in the information systems department. Another story which I think is quite significant from my career is actually, and again, kind of a life-changing story, is how my math teacher in grade 12 changed my life, and I became an engineer from what I was at the time, and which is a poet. I was known in school and in general in Romania as a creative writer. I won many contests. I was in TV, and as I mentioned maybe to you before, I was in radio with student cultural activities and promoting such activities as creative writing. And so I was pretty known as a poet, and of course in my high school, of course, even more so. So my math teacher came one day to class, and I used to sit in front. And so he came with a book by Leibniz, and he read us, he opened this book, he looked at the class. So you can understand the impact a mentor can really have on students' lives from this story as well. So he looked at us and he said, oh, look at this motto in Leibniz's book. The motto, I don't remember it exactly, but it was talking about one of Leibniz's students who gave up mathematics and became a poet. So Leibniz concluded, of course, he did not have enough imagination for mathematics. So the prof looked in my eyes when he said that. And then I felt so touched and so challenged that, of course, I went to him in the break, and I told him, well, I think I have enough creativity. So, you know, and he said, if you want to discover the creative side of mathematics, you know, I can help you. So he stood and took time for me after the hours and strived to inspire me with this creative side of mathematics and showing me that there's more than one proof to a theorem. And there's more, you know, more ways to look at the world through the lenses of mathematics and the beauty of it and the eureka feeling which one has when they can find a beautiful proof to a theorem. So, as a result of this, you know, he really inspired me to love the field and to look at it from a creative perspective rather than from, you know, you have to solve and remember this proof and so on and so forth. So you have to think in a creative way. So that led to me, that year I didn't participate in the creative writing competition anymore, but in the math competition, and I won. So that changed my life, and today I'm an engineer. And much, you know, to a great extent because of this this teacher. So I try to inspire my students with similar examples and drive them to love the field by emphasizing the importance and the challenges in achieving the purpose, such as, for example, as I mentioned, knowing the effect of a policy before it is applied by using predictive analytics on massive amounts of data available today. I mean, this is, I think, such a, you know, seems like an impossible thing, but we can do it. So, of course, both me and my students are now very committed to such goals.
I very much enjoyed those stories, and they truly represent inflection points in your life, from going from poetry to mathematics and then going into university and sort of focusing on that, you know, your particular domain, and then also in your first job as well. In an academic sense. It's just a kind of remarkable journey. Now, I'm also thinking of, you know, earlier you talked about policy and the impact and transformation. I just wanted to add this additional sort of question. You know, there's this global policy index that is from the IT Innovation Foundation and Rob Atkinson. And I just thought about this as we were going through this interview, and I thought, There may be some aspects of that work that you'd be engaged in. Are you working with Rob at all on any of his work? Or
No, I'm not working with Rob. So I'm working on global policy in different frames and contexts. My work is mainly targeting innovation and innovation frameworks, and of course finding solutions to global challenges, which requires systems dynamics and a global approach to interdependent networks, a complex systems approach. So there are many ways to look at and think about this. And of course, I am aware of many schools of thought, but I do not work directly with everyone. Yes, this is very hard, of course.
Well, we're down to our last question, and this is where I kind of turn the tables around. In other words, I'm asking, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
So you mean if I would conduct this interview with myself or with you?
with yourself.
Oh, okay. Well, what would I ask Mihaela Uliero? Well, probably first I'd like to know about her life journey and how did that shape who she is today. I'd like to know what is the essence that drives her work. Well, I would also like to know Mihaela Uliero's experience of being a successful woman, I would say, in a single mother, you know, and a single mother who she raised two babies along her career in a male-dominated field. How did she become an engineer from a poet, and what are her hobbies besides poetry? So the questions would go something like this. What drives your work, Mihaela Uliero? And I think I more or less answered this one. It's this insatiable drive. I think it's, at least for me, and that's why I believe it's for most of us, an insatiable drive to find answers to most difficult questions. I believe that us, humans, have been endowed with intellect and consciousness and have an intrinsic mission to explore the limits of the possible knowing and learn to push evolution further. I believe that this is our world, our role in the universe. Since I learned to read, my life has been a quest to find answers to the hardest questions and solutions to the most difficult challenges facing our world. And I've even written in my poetry about that. I've written about war, and I've written about love, and about the human condition, and it always comes so natural to me. And with time, as I became aware of the various problems facing humanity, this drive took the form of an arduous desire to save the world or change the world. So there's always an intrinsic drive to know more, to discover more, a feeling that I can see something, and if I can see something, a blind spot, that I can shed light on a blind spot, and I can share that awareness with my peers, we can make faster advances and make our world better, faster, sooner than later. And Mihaela Uliero is a woman in a male-dominated world, the engineering profession, which is undoubtedly, yes. I mean, this has been an interesting development as well, because in Romania, where I studied, there were more female students in my engineering faculty than men. And moreover, that's how I was, you know, that's all I knew. The first in class were always women. And then what I noticed when I moved to Germany for my PhD was, I was really very surprised that I was the first female in that department. And there were much less females in the hard discipline. So I was the first female PhD student in my professor's career. So I believe that I was lucky, though, to ride the wave of my career in sync with some awareness. And of course, I was part of this awareness for the, you know, lack of women in the engineering profession. So when I say I was part of it, it's because since I was doing my PhD, the ministress, it was a lady who was the Minister of Science and Technology in Land Hessen, where the Technical University of Darmstadt, where I studied for my PhD, was located. She instituted a special scholarship supporting women in the engineering disciplines. And she was inspired by my example, which my professor brought to her attention. So, of course, he was saying, well, I have to bring someone from Romania so I can have a female in my department. I mean, you know, why don't we have that in Germany? So this provided, anyway, nevertheless, this scholarship inspired, provided enormous support and encouraged me to further pursue my academic career. Then, after my first job in the UK, when I arrived in Canada for my postdoc, and that was another story, yes, because I met my mentor from Canada, Professor William Groover from Simon Fraser University at another conference in Vancouver. So timing was also very favorable there, since women were also highly supported to enter the academic field, especially in the hard disciplines, and the engineering professor was one. So I do not mean it was bed of roses and that, you know, I made it in my career because I'm a woman. And in no way, this would really do a lot of harm to all women who actually are daring enough to tackle, you know, this such a territory in, which is filled with mines and, you know, lots of dangers and hidden in the way hidden hostility, I would say. But there were lots of women advocates in universities when I arrived in Canada who helped me along the way. So it's not an easy ride. It was not an easy ride. But I had a lot of mentors, both male and female, along the way, who provided support and encouraged me to overcome the inherent disappointments along the way. This would be kind of a second question. So another question would be, and I think this is again a responsibility, and it's probably a direct derivative from the previous matter, and that is, what does it take to be a thought leader, and how do you become one? And of course, as a woman in the engineering discipline, as a successful woman, as I would think my career reflects, how do you become an example for other women? How do you become also, of course, a thought leader that can drive the discipline to new heights and can, you know, challenge ways of thinking, like, you know, promote emergent engineering or new ways of thinking about organization and knowledge societies, and be listened to? So I think, I do not think it's, first of all, you know, a woman or a man, anyone can be a thought leader if they have the courage to challenge the status quo, and of course, a passion to truly change it, and of course, be ready to risk everything for it. Because it's, you know, the danger of being marginalized and, you know, of making more enemies than friends when you challenge the status quo is there, and it's real. I experienced it in my life. I mean, from how our funding systems are set, that reviewers can easily say, well, who is this person to talk about emergent engineering? What is that emergent engineering? I mean, where is she established? What has she done before? Oh, she is a classical control engineer. How can she think about something so different? So, you know, how the systems are challenged when you challenge the status quo, and you can encounter all sorts of obstacles. But I see this as a responsibility, and I am ready to risk everything for it. A responsibility that, let's say, visionaries, those who can shed light on the blind spots, we have such a responsibility in our world, to point to the problems rather than at the solutions, and to the problems rather than at the symptoms, as I was mentioning before. And of course, this requires certain qualities which one can sharpen to augment, let's say, what our DNA has gifted us with, such as interdisciplinary education, fostering continuously our keen interest and constant desire to understand the essence of the issues from multiple perspectives, and to self-educate and read and learn continuously and be a part of society. And of course, to seek mentors and follow their inspiring example, as I just mentioned.
Mihaela, you've taken us on a remarkable journey during this interview, and you've shared many deep insights and your wisdom that you've gained and garnered through your remarkable career. And I know your schedule is demanding, and we are indeed fortunate that you have come in to do this interview. So thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you so much as well. I realize that with your questions, you've taken me through an amazing journey, which I did not anticipate in the beginning of this interview, which is, you know, a living, breathing again example of thinking about the future. So now I find myself kind of even more self-motivated. So thank you for the questions, and they were so stimulating and so empowering. I really would be very happy to do this again and think of other questions maybe for the next time.
Absolutely. And again, I really enjoyed this interview with you because you have this passion and you are a legendary figure in the industry in so many ways. So again, thank you for doing this interview. And I'm going to close the interview off by saying I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Professor Mihaela Uliru, President of Impact Institute, Global ICT Innovation Researcher, Luminary, and Authority.